This episode of On the Media is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio, offering the Stitcher mobile app. With Stitcher's free app for mobile phones, listeners can get the latest episodes of On the Media, NPR, and thousands of other podcasts on demand without downloading or syncing. The free Stitcher Smart Radio mobile app can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/media.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is on a reporting trip to Cairo this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Freedom of speech, guaranteed by the First Amendment to the Constitution, sometimes has the vilest of consequences. It permits the Westboro Baptist Church to stage protests at military funerals, assailing grieving families with hate rants about homosexuality and American apostasy. In 1977, the Supreme Court ruled that the American Nazi Party had the right under the First Amendment to parade before Holocaust survivors in the predominantly Jewish Chicago suburb of Skokie, Illinois. Freedom of speech is why flag desecration is a lawful act, no matter how it may dishonor the sacrifices of those who fought and died under that banner. And 2 weeks ago, freedom of speech gave Florida pastor Terry Jones licensed to set fire to a Koran in judgment of Islam's supposed crimes against God and man. And beginning last weekend came the consequences of that constitutionally protected act.
Thousands of Afghans filled Mazar-e-Sharif after Friday prayers, furious over news that pastors had burned a copy of the Quran.
At least 12 people, including six United Nations staff, have been killed in an attack on a UN guest house.
There's been further violence in Afghanistan following the burning of a Quran in the US last month. At least one person's been killed and 18 injured in a third day of protests.
Some commentators blamed Terry Jones for intentionally enraging violent radicals who regard blasphemy as punishable by death. Some blamed Islam itself for barbaric notions of justice. Yet others looked no further than the First Amendment. This was South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham speaking on CBS's Face the Nation.
You know, I wish we could find some way to hold people accountable. Free speech is a great idea, but we're in a war.
Yeah, a perverse publicity stunt in central Florida prompted a politician who has spoken more than once about defending our freedoms to float the idea of tinkering with one of the most uniquely American freedoms, the First Amendment. But in that regard, he is by no means alone. When the going gets tough, Americans have a tendency to treat the Bill of Rights like a luxury we cannot always afford. Andrew Kohut is president of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, whose polls consistently reveal the public's misgivings about the very principles that define our democracy. Andy, welcome back to OTM.
Happy to be with you.
Outlawing Koran burning on incitement grounds makes sense to Lindsey Graham. Outlawing flag burning on blasphemy grounds makes sense to a lot of people. At various moments in recent history, a majority of Americans have been willing to add at least one big fat asterisk to the First Amendment, right?
At least one, and probably more than one. The most famous is the broad support that we've seen for constitutional amendments that would make flag burning illegal. Back in 1989, 65% approved of this. That was at a time when this was very much a political issue. It was won in the 88 campaign. More recently, the last time we surveyed on this was in the middle of the last decade, we had 54% favoring such an amendment.
Every few years, going back to 1994, Pew has polled Americans on whether they believe that, quote, books containing dangerous ideas should be banned from school libraries. And consistently, a very sizable minority has said, yeah, I'm down with that. Book banning, no problem.
Well, we get in the most recent poll, which was only conducted last month, we get 57% saying no. I don't favor book banning that contain dangerous ideas, but 39% say they favor this idea. And this is what we've seen over the course of the years. And now this is akin to Americans saying, yes, you have freedom of expression, but yelling fire in a theater is just not appropriate.
I've noticed a kind of cognitive dissonance. I think that would be the nicest way I could phrase it, between our notion of going to war to protect our freedoms, a bit of rhetoric that is often mouthed, and Americans willing to suspend those very freedoms on the home front as a matter of national security. Has your polling given you any insight into the provenance of that kind of paradox?
Well, You know, we've seen a lot of that in more concrete terms over the years since 9/11, when we've polled about restricting civil liberties versus protecting the country from another terrorist attack. We get large percentages of people saying that they think that at least some of the time, torture can be justified to get information from terrorist suspects. We consistently found broad public support for the Bush administration's using warrantless wiretaps to gain information about terrorist suspects. When we ask people around the world, what do you think about Guantanamo? Most publics, certainly publics in Western Europe and in the Muslim world, say that they disapprove of this. Most Americans did not disapprove of Guantanamo. When the American public feels threatened, seriously threatened, it really goes on the warpath. And sometimes going on the warpath will involve suspension of these principles that are so central to the way we think about our democracy and our nation. There's a long record of Americans making these exceptions.
Andy, as always, thank you very, very much.
Okay, good to talk to you, Bob.
Andrew Cohide is president of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Jeffrey Stone is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago. He says that if the public and legislators are often weak in the knees about the First Amendment, the judiciary, by and large, has been consistent and resolute. This no more plainly than in 1977, when the Supreme Court granted the American Nazi Party the right to parade its hatreds before the scarred survivors of Nazism.
Individuals who had survived the Holocaust were appalled at the prospect that the Nazis would march on their hometown, and they basically said that, in part, the emotional distress that would be created by this event justified prohibiting the Nazis from marching. And the courts eventually held no, that the First Amendment gave the Nazis the right to march, and emotional distress was not a justification for restricting someone's free speech.
Now, there's inflicting offense and emotional pain, and then there is the Terry Jones case, the burning of the Koran, that he went through with probably the certain knowledge that it would lead to violence and death somewhere among radical Islamists elsewhere in the world. Does that change the sanctity of free speech at all?
Well, it certainly raises the stakes, because now the harm that's caused by the speech is much graver. Death. So the question is, well, can you suppress speech? Can you punish speech because it offends people to the point where they actually go out and kill somebody? There, the argument is much more difficult, of course. But having said that, the same slippery slope problem exists. So let's suppose that we were to hold that the reverend could be punished because the speech led to the death of individuals in Afghanistan. And now let's suppose that instead of that, that the city of New York prohibits the construction of a mosque near the site of 9/11. And radical Islamists are furious at the discrimination against Islam, and they go out and they kill people in protest. Does that mean that we have to allow the mosque? Or suppose that someone criticizes in a speech Islam as a violent religion, and jihadists somewhere in the world go out and they kill Americans in protest to that. Basically, what happens then is you encourage those who would suppress speech in the United States to exercise a power of censorship here by engaging in violence there. It's called the heckler's veto in First Amendment doctrine. And once you allow the heckler's veto, once you allow people to essentially cause you to silence speech because of their willingness to engage in criminal conduct, then you basically turned over the First Amendment to other people.
Although, in some respects, we do go down that road, do we not? I mean, freedom of expression is not absolute in this country. And there have been attempts by the government, particularly during wartime, to suppress speech. Can you give me some examples?
Sure. I mean, there's been a long history in the United States of government efforts, in particular in time of war, to restrict speech. For example, in World War I, the government made it a crime for any person to criticize the president, the Congress, the war, the flag, the military, the uniform of the military, the draft, and individuals were sentenced to prison terms of 10 to 20 years. And the rationale was that such criticism would undermine morale in the United States. It would strengthen the will of the enemy. And the Supreme Court initially upheld those prosecutions. And over time, what's happened in the United States is we went from what we thought was common sense to an understanding that common sense with respect to free speech in particular, is not a very sensible way of going about defining the scope of the rights.
And hence the genius of the founders. The First Amendment is constructed on a principle that may intellectually scan perfectly, as you've just elucidated, but just, you know, in many ways just feels so wrong.
Well, the genius really is not just of the founders, it's of the Supreme Court, because the founders themselves didn't know exactly what they meant by the First Amendment. It's important to remember that the Sedition Act of 1798, which was enacted less than a decade after the First Amendment was adopted, made it a crime for any person to criticize the president or the government of the United States. And many of those people involved in the crafting of the First Amendment supported the constitutionality of the Sedition Act. So even the framers didn't really know what the constitutional guarantee of free speech necessarily meant. That's something that it took us 200 years of living with it and trying to figure out from trial and error how to make it work that we finally thus far seem to have figured out pretty well. And the way you can see that progress is, you know, during World War I, as I said, people who criticized the war were put in jail for 10 to 20 years. During the Vietnam War or during the post 9/11 period, we didn't put people in jail for criticizing the war. We came to understand that free speech in American politics and self-governance demanded that individuals have the freedom to criticize the government, to criticize the war, to criticize our policies, even though it might have negative consequences, because otherwise we would be crippling the very self-governance that the society is meant to preserve.
Jeffrey, thank you very much.
My pleasure, as always.
Jeff Stone is a law professor at the University of Chicago. Coming up, how the Quran burning almost went unnoticed, and getting information out of both Libya and North Korea calls for stamina and ingenuity. This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Constant Contact, offering an event marketing service that provides registration tools to small businesses and nonprofits. ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. And in this segment, we explore the difficulty of suppressing inconvenient news. It's hard for governments. It's hard for dictators. It's even hard for the media themselves. Our coverage begins with this conundrum. If a Koran is burned in Florida and nobody reports it, is it still an outrage? Well, we almost found out. For more than a week after Pastor Terry Jones's incendiary stunt, news of the incident reached virtually no Americans and very few abroad. That's because local and national news organizations had previously resolved not to reward a bigoted provocateur with the publicity he craved. But one young stringer of one foreign press agency did file a story, which eventually was noticed in Afghanistan, whereupon all hell broke loose. Steve Myers is the managing editor of Pointer.org, the website of the Media Ethics and Best Practices Organization, and he's delved into the timeline of this story. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So a week ago, you're reading the newspaper, and you see that there are demonstrations in Afghanistan in response to the Quran burning by Terry Jones, and your first reaction was, what Quran burning by Terry Jones?
I thought I had totally missed the story. It was really bizarre that this, you know, had happened and I knew nothing about it.
And you discovered that there was a near-perfect conspiracy of silence by the press. As you began to dig into this, tell me what you discovered.
I didn't really see any coverage inside the United States. It was all international. they all basically came back to the same Agence France Press story, an AFP story. And when I did a little bit of digging, I found that most of the media locally and some national media had decided to ignore this event.
They had decided to do so because it was staged for no other purpose than to get the attention of the press. And they decided, therefore, you know, either individually or as a group, not to give him the benefit of the very attention he was seeking.
Yes, it looks like these news organizations made this call individually. At the AP, they basically decided that this is a stunt, that we're not going to give a microphone to someone who's preaching intolerance. At the local newspaper, at the Gainesville Sun, they had had misgivings like other media about how this went down last fall. A lot of media up there felt like it was a media circus and that they had been played. So when they got the initial press releases, they decided, we're not going to give him oxygen like we did last year. We're just going to ignore this.
It was a bit of self-restraint that I wish as a news consumer were exercised more often.
I spoke with the imam in Orlando who sent a statement imploring the media this spring to not cover this. And the imam told me that when he was up there last fall, many of the media knew that they were being manipulated, but they didn't know how they could get out of the story because they were already there. Everyone was already covering this, so they didn't feel like they could just walk away.
So while the press may have acted as individual news organizations, more or less by accident, in concert by ignoring the story, they did so at the urging of this local Florida imam. His name is Mohammed Muzri, right? And he sent out what was in effect an anti-press release.
Yes. When the imam was contacted for the first couple of stories in January, he made appeals to the reporters themselves, asking them to consider the impact of this. And then after the second or third interview request, he sent a statement to all the media that he had contact with. He actually gave the news organizations the advice that our faculty was giving last fall, which is to consider other ways of covering this story that don't just play into Terry Jones's hands.
As it happens, at least one reporter didn't get the memo, and it was a young stringer for Agence France-Presse. When did he file his story, and what happened next?
Yeah, Andrew Ford went to the church on March 20th, and he covered this theatrical mock trial in which the Quran ended up being, what a surprise, found guilty, and then they burned the Quran, which was really the point of this event all along. The stringer for AFP filed his story describing the burning, and that ended up getting posted online a couple hours later in the middle of the night. And then he tracks the story over the next day or so, and he finds that the story has been distributed widely around the world. It just wasn't being reported in the United States.
Now, on the one hand, I'm all for journalistic best practices, and I'm certainly for not feeding the flames of a publicity stunt. By the same token, we in the press are always at pains to explain to the public that no, we are not a monolith and we are not working together to impose some sort of agenda on the world. But should I be nervous that so many news organizations did act apparently in concert to stifle this story up until the point that Agence France-Presse broke it?
I don't know that you should be nervous. I think that the fact that the news organizations thought about this hard before running after what would have been a sensational story, that's good. I mean, it's good that they had these discussions. It does raise interesting questions, though. These days, we think that there are no secrets. And so the strange thing about this story is how close this came to not being reported.
Steve, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
Steve Myers is the managing editor of Pointer.org. In the battle for public opinion, even tyrants don't like bad press. But that is precisely what Muammar Gaddafi was getting during a month of civil protests and insurrection by Libyans determined to overthrow his regime. Foreign news organizations long shut out of Libya were getting most of their information by telephone from protesters and armed rebels. So Gaddafi's government invited foreign journalists to cover the story from Libya itself, with the help of government minders eager to portray the revolution in a very different light. This set up a game of cat and mouse, with journalists trying to report under the watchful eyes of regime henchmen, and regime henchmen trying to make sure the reporters didn't get a chance to see anything that could make the regime look bad. Consider, for example, a Ministry of Information-sponsored trip to the previously rebel-controlled city of Zawiya, during which the minders failed to notice New York Times journalists wandering into a burned-out police station. Reporter David Kirkpatrick was one of them.
I was running around trying to evade my government minders, as I usually do, and our resourceful photographer, Moises Salmon, wandered into a burned-out police station where he found an office with photographs strewn all over the floor. A number of them were unmistakably pictures of people who have been tortured. He took a photograph of those photographs on the floor, which made a kind of naturally occurring montage, and we used that in our story to point out that this baleful human rights record is likely to hang over the Gaddafi regime as it now tries to reach out and assure the West that it's ready for a transition to democracy.
Well, taking a busload of Western reporters to a scene of incriminating evidence is certainly a PR don't. How did the Gaddafi government react to your piece in the Times?
The government didn't have any complaints. Instead, they've been very concerned about something they say I've done that I can't figure out that I've done. A couple people in the government PR office said that I've reported about the rebel-held city of Misrata as though I was in the city when I wasn't. I don't think I've done that. I've done a lot of reporting, talking over the internet and other ways with people who are there to try to get their description. And I try usually to note that their stories are impossible to confirm because the government won't let us go there.
Well, that would be a breach of journalism ethics if you did it, but it's kind of hilarious that in the face of incriminating photographs, that's what the government would be concerned with.
In some ways, it sort of encapsulates the way this country operates. In the West, we're accustomed more or less to the rule of law. But here, threats and promises can't be trusted, and punishments are likely to be arbitrary. So if you do something wrong, that's probably not what you'll get in trouble for. And if you don't, you have no idea what you'll get in trouble for.
We were sitting around the office just marveling at this particular story because we felt as though that you and your colleagues on the ground in Libya were, you know, something like the East Germans who went into the Stasi offices after the fall of the Berlin Wall. You're the first Western eyes into this sick regime. Are you feeling like that?
We are getting the first glimpses in many ways of things that have been hidden, but we're only seeing a little bit here and there through the cracks, to be honest. I often have joked to my colleagues that I feel like my role here is theater critic. They staged these elaborate demonstrations for us, and increasingly the people who are putting them on don't even pretend they're not staged. You know, a busload of people will show up, pretend to be residents of a certain city, shout about Gaddafi for a little while, and then before we even get onto our bus and leave, they've all piled into their cars and buses and made their way out of town. Or in another instance, we're carted out to a soccer field in the night and a huge crowd is waiting to demonstrate. And then as they're trying to rush us back onto the bus, we see that the whole crowd has been waiting for their chance to pick up bags of free groceries at the back of the field.
Okay, so I get that the government is untrustworthy, but are they also such rank amateurs that they think a room full of Western journalists aren't going to figure out that they have not, in fact, presented the habeas corpus?
In a world before they invited the press in, frankly, we were getting accounts only from people who hated the government because they were the only ones who would talk to us, and their accounts were inflammatory. They realized that having no members of the foreign press here, only the other side was getting any word out. And I think they feel like the strategy of inviting us in has been, all in all, successful. At least they get a little bit of voice in the coverage.
Another story that got a lot of international media attention because it played out in front of a room filled with international media was that of Iman al-Obaidi, a woman who burst into a room full of journalists and accused Libyan security forces of raping her. Were you there that day?
I was there. She burst into the hotel restaurant where many of us were having breakfast. And as she began to tell her story of being kidnapped and raped for 2 days by members of the Gaddafi militia, security forces in the hotel raced to try to grab her. And to our surprise, many of the people who had previously seemed to be hotel staff began working in tandem with the security forces to try to silence her and remove her from the room. One young woman who worked at the coffee bar tried to pull a dark coat over this woman's head, calling her a traitor and trying to pull her out of the room.
Now, you're not a newbie, David. Has there been anything in this experience, though, that shocked even you?
The Imad Al-Mahdi experience was pretty tough to watch. Some of the reports of torture that I've heard have been very affecting. I will say, though, that it is incredibly moving when I am within a few yards of a government minder and some Libyan risks their life to tell me that the theater that's being put on is not the whole story, that other Libyans feel differently, that things are going to change, and that they look forward to that day. It's hard to describe how gratifying that is.
David, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
David Kirkpatrick is the Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Tripoli. For clamping down on information, in or out, it would be hard to top the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Its leaders are enigmatic, its policies cryptic, its authoritarianism absolute. The non-governmental organization Freedom House ranked North Korea dead last, that's 196 out of 196, in its 2010 Press Freedom Index. So information travels across the border the hard way or not at all. But thanks to some very determined journalists in recent years, the hard way now exists. According to Robert Boynton in the April issue of The Atlantic, quote, a half dozen independent news organizations have been launched to communicate with North Koreans to bring news out of the country and to get potentially destabilizing information in. Boynton's piece is called North Korea's Digital Underground. Rob, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me here.
Let's start with how you got this story. You traveled to South Korea and spent time with the groups who were behind this operation.
I've been traveling to the region for the past 3 years, and actually in 2008, I was in Seoul, and I was interviewing some people at the Daily NK, which is one of these journalism organizations, and my translator said to me, or reported what had been said to me, that there were these reporters inside North Korea we were getting information from, and I had to stop and ask the translator to repose the question and retranslate the answer because I just couldn't frankly believe that there were actually reporters inside North Korea.
Yeah, it's kind of a surprising development to imagine that there's active journalism going on between North and South. How does it work?
It works in many different sorts of ways. There are all sorts of informants and reporters of one sort or another in North Korea who are going back and forth over the border between North Korea and China. They will sometimes bring little SD chips or thumb drives or cameras with photographs on them or other digital files and give them usually to people on the other side of the border in this large area where there are a lot of defectors and refugees from North Korea. There are also many cell phones which are used to communicate from North Korea to China. The Chinese have set up many different cell towers all along that border. And some of these cell phones are even capable of transmitting video and audio files. So there are all sorts of different ways from handing off something to sending it digitally.
Your piece focused substantially on an organization called Daily NK, an online news site. Tell me about the Daily NK. Who are they and what specifically are they after?
The Daily NK is sort of the oldest and most established of these various independent news organizations, and it has about 17 or so journalists in Seoul who have active connections to and communication with their reporters and other people inside North Korea, also inside China, where a lot of the reporting goes on. One of the founders, the co-founder of the Daily NK, is a man named Park In-ho, and he spends a good part of his life in China talking to refugees, talking to people who have crossed over the border, and cultivating and getting to know people who are interested in going back. I mean, one thing you have to understand is that in the last 10 years, the number of people going back and forth between North Korea and China has just risen exponentially, generally trading goods and food. So he has been using this dynamic as a way to recruit and convince people to, in their passage back and forth, to bring information for him as well.
Can you give me examples of particularly vivid or revealing or shocking information that has come out of North Korea? And equally, can you tell me what has been smuggled in that you think might have had the most effect in the North?
the kind of things that have come out that have been most shocking have tended to be video. There have been very widely circulated videos of public executions. There have been widely circulated videos of children starving. There's a horrifying video of very skinny, obviously stunted children. They have a phrase for these. They call them kochebi, which are sort of fluttering swallows. These are street children whose parents have died, most likely in the famine, who are surviving by going around the markets and picking little bits of grain off, or if you leave a noodle in your bowl of soup you've just bought, they'll go and eat that. You know, those kind of photographs and video of those things have probably been the most shocking. One of the things I found the most interesting, though, was that so much of the journalism that comes through these organizations is really the sort of workaday journalism that anyone would do. Are the markets in Wonsan full or empty? How is the rice crop going? Things like that. And those sort of unspectacular claims are the ones I used actually to try to verify a lot of this information, because those are the things that were probably easiest to check.
I'm curious about what gets smuggled in.
Some of the things that are being brought in are e-books on thumb drives. There's one e-book called Welcome to the World, kind of an almanac of sorts, telling the history of and facts about South Korea and the rest of the world. And the head of the organization, North Korean Intellectual Solidarity, Kim Hyung-kwang, is interested in taking the Korean version of Wikipedia, reducing it to a thumb drive, and distributing that throughout North Korea.
Is it possible to gauge from outside the country the impact within?
There have been many studies of defectors in China who have just left North Korea that have looked into their media habits. And one thing that has come across was that as North Koreans' media consumption increases, they become more and more suspicious of and less well-disposed towards the regime. So the very fact of consuming non-official, non-sanctioned media is having an effect of some sort.
Rob, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
Robert Boynton is director of the Literary Reportage Concentration at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University. His article, North Korea's Digital Underground, is in the April issue of The Atlantic. Coming up, expropriating the English language, two dictionaries of slang. This is On the Media.
This episode of On the Media is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of On the Media, NPR, and other shows while on the go without downloading or syncing with Stitcher Smart Radio. Thousands of popular podcasts and programs are available on demand. Stitcher instantly delivers new episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone without syncing or downloading. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, former Senator Christopher Dodd, the new CEO of Hollywood's trade group, the MPAA, declared film piracy to be the single biggest threat to his industry. On Monday of this week, the music industry's trade group, the RIAA, asked a court to reinstate a $675,000 verdict against a student in Boston who was caught sharing 30 music files online. And today, Michael Gallagher, head of the video game industry's leading trade group, actually, we're not quite sure what Michael Gallagher was up to today, because although computer games are theoretically as easy to pirate as any other kind of digital media, the video and computer game industry as a whole seems a little less caught up in anti-piracy zeal. Robin Walker is a game developer for Valve Software, one of the more successful computer game publishers. He says that, at least in his industry, combating piracy doesn't mean criminalizing file sharing. It means offering a better product than pirates can.
I think it's looking at the things that pirates are providing and asking yourselves how you can provide something better than that. So, to pick an example, if you purchased a product from us, we're going to continue working on that product after we've released it. We're sort of making that initial purchase of the product significantly more valuable over time. And so if you somehow manage to get it for free initially, but not in a way that lets you plug into that system, you know, that's going to be a big hassle for you as you continue to try and figure out how to get each of those incremental improvements over the next few years for free as well.
Now, do you charge for the game and then that's the last transaction? Or is that like owning a subscription that you continue to pay for as the game automatically updates itself?
We don't charge for the ongoing updates. You know, one of the things that are interesting as you look at the internet in general and its impact on media, it's created what we call network effects. If we take action one day that somehow brings another 50,000 or 100,000 people to the game, all of our existing customers just got happier. Their game literally just got better. And so we sort of focus on not necessarily trying to figure out how to get more money out of you specifically, but how we can use you as a valued customer to attract more customers.
And that's particularly true because it's a multiplayer online game, right? So the quality, at least in theory, is measurably better the larger the pool of players is, right?
Absolutely. But I think the internet makes that somewhat true of almost all forms of media. You know, if you're a fan of something, whether it's music or movie or something, there are other people on the internet who are excited of fans of the same thing, and that there's sort of value to you in finding them and creating something of your own that shows you're a fan of that and all those kinds of things that's possible to build a business around it.
All right. Now, I noticed that you have figured out a way to separate your growing number of users from their money and to do so in a way that discourages piracy. Tell me about that.
We also put our products in retail. One of the other things we kept finding was that we had some customers who had already bought the product from us who were starting to send us kind of strange emails like, do you guys have a tip jar or something like that where I can, you know, I sort of feel guilty about the amount of free content I've got from you in the last couple of years. I'd like to give you some more money. So we created a system which allows you to purchase additional stuff that you can use to customize your character and sort of show that you're a fan. But to us, they're all just specific implementations of solving the core problem, which is when people like something, they want to be able to show they like it. And one of the best ways you can do that as a customer is to send some money at it.
Our producer, PJ Vogt, is himself a huge fan of Team Fortress 2. In addition, he's extremely impatient and a total loser. And as a consequence, instead of painstakingly accumulating power in this game, he buys it retail from you.
Right.
And he couldn't do that if he didn't have a licensed version of Team Fortress 2, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And again, it's one of the reasons why being a legitimate customer has higher value than being an illegitimate customer. He also gets to play with all the other legitimate customers. So, you know, the decision he makes is validated to some extent by the other people who care about it as well.
Well, you know, that sounds like a very pragmatic philosophy. It's not one embraced by the recording industry or Hollywood, who have, you know, engaged in wholesale lawsuits against pirates. You know, I'm wondering if your model has any applications to other kinds of content that is easily pirated online.
If you look back at the time when the sort of piracy of music started really taking off, one of the things that I think was a key component of that was that fundamentally the service provided by the software tools people were using to pirate were better tools than the legitimate tools in the world that allowed you to find music that you might like. And I think the success of things like iTunes has shown that when those legitimate tools come along and they catch up, that they succeed as well. I think customers are fundamentally honest.
Have you been drinking? I mean, iTunes does well, but it only captures about, you know, some small percentage of the download market, like maybe one or two, and the other 98% worldwide is stolen. I mean,
I have been drinking. Obviously, I'm much more aware of our space than other spaces, but to us, it's a pragmatic problem, right? It's not something you solve by taking philosophical attitudes towards what's piracy and what's not and what's right and what's not. You tack it much more to what can we work on that will result in the most value generated at the end of the day.
Robin, thank you very, very much.
No problem. Thanks for talking to me.
Robin Walker is a game developer for Valve Software. Online, pirates expropriate what does not belong to them and often feel righteous in so doing, infuriating the man. The coiners and speakers of slang do approximately the same thing, to approximately the same effect. Here's what lexicographer Jonathan Green has to say on that subject. Quote, slang is the language that says no. Born in the street, it resists the niceties of the respectable. It is impertinent, mocking, unconvinced by rules, regulations, and ideologies. It remains something apart. And for many, that is where it should stay. That's from Green's introduction to the Dictionary of Slang, a three-volume, $450, more than 6,000-page collection of 110,000 English-language slang terms defined and meticulously cited in almost 10.6 million text words that survey more than 500 years of slang. In other words, Green has taken the ultimate in fleeting language and pinned it down in the single most authoritative slang collection ever assembled. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So first, let's define our terms. For your purposes, what is slang?
It's unsurprisingly about crime. It's about drink, and obviously since the 20th century, about drugs. It's about sex. It's about bigging yourself up. It's about putting other people down. It's about men who are wonderful. It's about women who are sex objects. It's about mad people, fat people. It's about racism. It's about nationalism. Not all slang is international. The book is international. It takes in the States, the UK, takes in Australia, it takes in New Zealand, the English-speaking bits of South Africa, the Caribbean, and it takes in Ireland. But what interested me doing it and what's changed for people being in England, there's no possible way that somebody working at the over the last 17 years could possibly exclude America. It would be mad. I mean, we all talk American slang now.
So why do we need slang? I mean, we know it's colorful. We know it's often witty. We know subversive and anti-authoritarian. But language is pretty comprehensive. Why do we need to embellish it with slang?
I think you have to go back to where slang comes from, criminal language. And what criminals were about, and I'm talking the 1500s here, what criminals are always about is secrecy, is not letting the authorities, not letting the public know what they're up to. And their language was the first slang to be collected. I'm sitting in the tavern, and there is a guy over there who's known as the Harmon Beck, which means a magistrate in my language. Now, in the first place, I don't wish him to know that I know who he is, so I call him the Harmon Beck, and I don't wish him to know who I am, so I'm using this strange language to talk about him. And what you get with slang is that there is this desire to have, as it were, private insider languages. And as soon as a word gets, or a phrase gets known, it gets replaced.
There's one category of slang that particularly intrigues me, and it's the hundreds or thousands of ways that young people come to express the notion of good. Just in my lifetime, there have been many, from cool to groovy to keen to fine to sweet to the cat's pajamas.
The interesting thing about those is that they're the positive group. What you've also had is like the negative group: bad, wicked, sick. I mean, they in a way are the perfect exemplars of the subversion, because my parents say good, I say bad. You can go back much further, and there's the word rum. Rum is a word, again, in the 16th century that means really good to the beggars, to the criminals. So rum becomes, in standard English, means bad. He's a rum cove. He's an odd fellow. But rum, as far as Rumville used to be London, it was the best place. It was the great ville, the best city.
There must be some favorite turns of phrase or slang vocabulary that just delight you. Please share with me some of the Hall of Fame.
What excites me is not the individual words. They're all my babies. I love them all. What it's all about is the chase. Let me give you an example. There's a word hoopty, means a rusty old car. So in the printed book, you'll find that hoopty dates back to 1968. Trouble is, hoopty doesn't date back to 1968, because I now know better, because I've still been chasing. And I happened to buy the other day a collection of Black Mask magazine, the great old pulp magazine that was the first place for Dashiell Hammett, for Raymond Chandler, for a bunch of other people back in the 20s and 30s. And there, in a story from 1939, bingo, there is hoopty. That makes my day. The Holy Grail is pushing it back, finding the earlier date. Some of it, you know, some of it, Dr. Johnson is right, you're a harmless drudge. There's no doubt about it. It's very hard, perhaps, to make this side of lexicography as exciting to others as it is to me, but it is to me.
You've just invoked Dr. Johnson, perhaps history's most famous lexicographer. My guess is he's also an entry in another dictionary of slang, the Urban Dictionary, because his name sort of sounds filthy, and that's what the Urban Dictionary is. It is a vast, vast collection of probably real slang and a lot of, you know, fancy neologisms for things that are dirty or naughty or actually quite repulsive. And I wonder what your thoughts are about the Urban Dictionary.
The Urban Dictionary is the antithesis of what I do. I don't want to be, no, the hell with it, I will be snotty. The Urban Dictionary is amateur hour. They're students at 4 a.m, out of their heads, and having fun and sending this stuff in. So for me, the Urban Dictionary is playtime, but it's got nothing to do with lexicography. And I think an awful lot of it hasn't got that much to do with slang.
I'm going to get to the larger subject of setting about to collect and document 500 years of slang. First of all, it's a losing proposition because by the time you submit your manuscript, there are 1,000 or 10,000 more words of slang that you have no access to. It's a moving target, no?
It's totally a moving target, and there is no such thing as a completist dictionary, or not of the sort that I want to write. I have an image which is not my image, but I can't remember to my shame who thought it up. But if you think of the language as a big train that is moving across a vast continent, and as the lexicographer, all you can do is you jump on the train and you start cataloguing everything that's in those trucks, everything that's in those carriages. Then you jump off. Now, the train, of course, keeps moving. It is possible that you can jump on again later and you can pick up, maybe there's a couple more carriages, you can catalogue them again. But you can never catalogue all of them because the train will be moving long after you're alive and it was moving long before you were born. And all one can do is make the catalogue that is accessible. But the idea of completism, the idea of getting everything, no, it's quite impossible. Any lexicographer will tell you that.
Jonathan, it's been groovy. Thank you very much.
It's been real.
Jonathan Green is the author of the 3-volume Dictionary of Slang. For academic slang's lexicographers, citations are essential. But let's say you're slightly heavily intoxicated and it's 3 a.m. and you're puzzled over the meaning of the word, say, skank, and you're less concerned with scholarship than street cred. You might consider the Urban Dictionary. It's a website of modern vernacular, much of it repulsive, graphic, fanciful, and wincingly uproarious. It's so uproarious, in fact, that the 3 a.m. Urban Dictionary clicker-oner is just as likely to be drunkenly coining a neologism as seeking clarity on somebody else's. But the site is no mere online parlor game. It is sometimes authoritative. For example, a State Department of Motor Vehicles once cited it, trying unsuccessfully to stop a driver from using H-O-E on his license plate. So what started 10 years ago as a college student's hobby is now an evolving cultural document. Aaron Peckham was that college student. We talked to him in 2009, and he said he started the site partly out of boredom, partly to document how he and his roommates actually talked.
And I thought that a dictionary would be more legitimate if the definitions were written by normal people who speak the language. So all 4 million definitions that have been submitted to Urban Dictionary in the last 10 years were written by random people from around the world who just happened to find my website and found it missing a particular word like skank or something like that.
One of the delights and simultaneously one of the most appalling things about the Urban Dictionary is the level of graphic detail that you find in definitions to terms that on the face of it don't sound all that repulsive. And yet you discover that, a common household term or, a menu item can actually refer to something that is just a bit on the off-color side. Did these things exist before you, or have they been kind of created by a subculture of people who want to be in the lexicon?
I can't tell if these words existed with these meanings before Urban Dictionary, but that's kind of the part of the fun of visiting the site is that a lot of the definitions are totally false. They're definitely not objective. And so it's really the reader's responsibility to figure out if the definition you're reading is relevant to you or whether it's accurate.
All right. Now, our producer, Nazanin Rafsanjani, has a personal favorite. It is, Mom, I'm sorry. Food douche.
Food douche. A person that thinks they know the best place to get any one specific item of food, and that the places you know all suck.
Keep reading.
Jason says, I love this turkey sandwich. Joey says, This sandwich sucks. I know a place with the best turkey sandwich I've ever had. Jason says, you are such a food douche.
Okay, now even that's a little edgy. Have you got any that isn't going to make anybody wince?
Every day I pick one of my favorite definitions on Urban Dictionary and put it on the front page. The other day that word was joke insurance. Joke insurance is when two friends have a mutual understanding to laugh at each other's jokes even when they're not funny. One of my other favorite definitions is afterclap. An afterclapper is the person who continues to clap even after the rest of the audience has stopped clapping. Another of my favorite definitions, just finger guns. A way for creepy people with mustaches to say hello or I understand. Hold your fingers in the shape of guns and point at someone who just arrived. Bend thumbs to simulate shooting your finger guns and make a clicking sound with your mouth.
All right, Aaron. I can't take this anymore.
many, glad you enjoyed
many
it.
Many thanks.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Aaron Peckham is the founder of UrbanDictionary.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdurrahman. Our show was edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and she had help from Dylan Keefe. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week to tell us what she found in Cairo. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.